Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. You're about to hear a fascinating, slightly rambling conversation with Thomas Frank. Tom Frank is the columnist of the Easy Chair column at Harper's Magazine every month. And today he expands on his most recent column, where after heavy exposure of the behind-the-scenes antics of the Tea Party, he decides to take a look at the Democrats and how they're already making excuses about why they may not be successful in the midterm elections this coming November. Lots more that Tom Frank and I discuss in this nearly hour-long conversation. It's straight ahead for you. But first, I'd like to thank the people who subscribe and support the work that I do here, like Dan Shannon, Alan Ventress, Bernice Delorto, and Diane Morris. They are monthly subscribers, and you can do it too. Just go to peterbcollins.com. You follow the link that says sign up right under my picture on the homepage. You can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever's comfortable for you. Or our best deal, the annual $50 subscription. And if you sign up now for our annual subscription, I've got a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee to send you. It's inbound now from the Big Island of Hawaii. And I'll select a bonus book for your edification as well. The other way you can support us, and I just got my first check from Audible.com that is driven by people like you who take up the free offer for a one-month trial subscription at no cost over at Audible. And they'll give you your first audiobook download from 150,000 titles, absolutely free. And when you do that, even if you cancel before the end of the month, Audible will pay me $15 because I persuaded you to try out Audible.com. Isn't that cool? It is a no-cost, no-risk way that you can kick in $15 to support our work here. And I hope you'll do it very soon. Thomas C. Frank, the Easy Chair columnist from Harper's Magazine, returns for his first appearance of 2014. And he's written a very upbeat column that'll make him many friends inside the Beltway and over at the Democratic National Committee. And that's why he's such a frequent contributor over at MSNBC. Tom Frank, welcome back to the Peter B. Collins Show.
How are you today, Peter B. Collins?
Are you inspired by the Up With People theme? Does it really get where you live?
You should play that whenever I come on. That's like, you know, wasn't that Richard Nixon's favorite band or something? Didn't he love that band, Up With People?
Well, it was a marriage of convenience. You know, the music came out at the time he was in trouble, and you know, he was accepting support from Reverend Moon and from the Up With People and just about anybody who'd say something nice about him.
Wherever he could get it, that's right.
Yeah. Well, hey, how have you been? We haven't talked for a few months, and we're into a whole new year now.
Yep. I am great. I'm in a good mood. I'm having trouble getting back into the swing of things, you know, and thinking critically and all that stuff. But I'll be back in the saddle soon.
But it's a midterm election year. A pundit like you,
I know. I'm going to be busy later on. But
you sharpen your elbows and get ready to throw a few, right?
I'm not that kind of pundit, Peter B. Collins. I mean, I'm not your DC. Even when I was a columnist for the Wall Street Journal, I didn't do that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not who I am.
Yeah. Who am you?
Oh, hell if I know.
The existential
question. I'm a lost soul. I should have been in academia, but academia isn't what I want to be either, you know? My heroes are like H.L. Mencken, you know, he wasn't a liberal. He wasn't even one on the left. He was the opposite. But this is a man that, you know, disagreed with all established wisdom and just could not stop himself from mocking, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Constantly mocking everyone. But had a heart of gold, you know, despite that his cruel exterior.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we dive into your latest column, which I think has very well-deserved criticism of the Democratic Party and its leaders, you mentioned academia, and a couple of months ago, Bill Ayers dropped by here, and he talked about his new book, Public Enemy, which is a fascinating memoir, his personal experience.
Yeah, I want to see that. I want to read that book.
Of being on the receiving end of the Hillary Clinton campaign, amplified by Fox News and George Stephanopoulos over at ABC, where they turned Bill Ayers into a caricature. And he had to basically just keep his head down and plow through the satellite trucks that camped out in front of his house. And in one of the acknowledgments of the book, he dropped your name. And so I wanted to explore that a little bit. Are you, you know, longtime friends of Bill and Bernardine?
I guess I am now, because it's been, when did I meet them? It would have been in the late 90s.
At an Obama fundraiser.
No, I knew that he was friends with Obama, or that he was an acquaintance of Obama anyways, but
yeah.
But no, that's not how I met him, because I used to be the editor of the Baffler magazine in Chicago, and we were having a lot of trouble with fundraising, and Bill lived in the neighborhood, and many people that we contacted said, oh, you know, you're having trouble with fundraising. This is the guy to talk to. He knows everything there is to know about this subject. And so I never – and that was the first time I met him. And, you know, I knew all about the Weathermen.
Mm-hmm.
I had actually written a book about the 60s called The Conquest of Cool, where I have a collection of, like, new left materials somewhere around this house, including a including some Weathermen stuff, which is just, you know, well, crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was a really strange period in American life.
Yes, it was.
I knew who he was, but he turned out to be just the sweetest individual, just the nicest man, and was extremely helpful to us, and Bernardine as well. And yeah, I became friends with them, and I wrote about this in the. I wrote about this in the Wall Street Journal when the, you know, when the this was at its most heated moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know that when this was during that campaign in 08, when I had forgotten that Hillary Clinton had a hand in this, because I remember it being Sarah Palin. You know,
no, it started with the Clinton campaign feeding questions to George Stephanopoulos. On the day when there was going to be one of the dozens of debates that had been held.
Yeah.
And they were trying to get him, they were feeding him the question. And at the same time, Sean Hannity was stoking it, because he'd kind of run out of footage of Reverend Wright and was looking looking for a new South Side of Chicago boogeyman to...
Yeah, that's right. So I wrote a column about, when all this was going on, I wrote a column for the Wall Street Journal about the Bill Ayers that I knew, and they put the unforgettable headline on it, "My friend Bill Ayers."
You're palling around.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right. I actually do pal around with Bill Ayers when I'm in Chicago, and man, did I get hate mail for that.
Oh, I'll bet.
But one of the things that I did in that article, which, you know, was easy to do, and any journalist could have done it had they wanted to, was call people that Bill worked with. There's lots of people who know him personally and can, you know, vouch for him being a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, I mean, we weren't talking about him in the 1960s. That's all, you know, that's a different story. But he, you know, people that he works with today, including conservatives. One of the people that I included in this, that I quoted in the story, was a libertarian professor.
One of the really cute anecdotes in his book Public Enemy is how somehow Andrew Breitbart won at a charity auction dinner with Bill and Bernadine.
Yeah, and Bill told me about this. I know the story.
And he actually went through with it, and Andy shows up, and apparently they had a pretty good time.
Yeah. Now, I met Breitbart, too. It's a strange small world that we're in. I met Breitbart once, and, he had, he had a famous public persona for being a dick, an absolute jerk.
Right.
Like snarling and yelling at people and calling people vile names. And when I met him, it was in a green room before going on TV, of course, right? That's where you meet people like this. Mm-hmm. He was a really nice guy. And he had written a book with a guy who had been a columnist for Spy magazine, and I loved Spy magazine in the day.
Sure.
And so we started talking about that, and he had loved Spy magazine too. And suddenly I put two and two together. Remember how Breitbart was behind all these sort of really mean pranks on Acorn? Do you remember that?
Oh yeah.
And then I got it that's what this guy was after from his own sort of twisted right-wing point of view.
Yeah, he hired James O'Keefe, who claims to be a journalist, runs a nonprofit now called the Veritas Project, and O'Keefe, pretended that this whole thing has been exposed.
I want to take
a minute here to give credit to a dogged blogger named Brad Friedman at Brad Blog in Los Angeles, because he went after O'Keefe on these videos that they fed to Fox, where he and a girlfriend posed as pimp and hoe and went in and tried to break the law with the aid and abetting of Acorn. And what Friedman was able to prove was that O'Keefe never entered an Acorn office in this outfit.
It was
selectively edited, but the New York Times and other mainstream publications picked up without challenging the footage once it was aired on Fox, and they reported it as fact. And Friedman,
the outrageous costume.
Yes, and no, Friedman that's finally true. Got they, finally got the Times to issue a partial retraction. Yeah. It took him months.
But they did a bunch of things like this, and so I finally got it that what the idea was at least in part was a kind of prank. It was meant to be humorous to a certain degree. Well, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say that with because Breitbart wasn't a funny man.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, we're getting off the track here.
Well, but no, so wait. This is a perfect transition point, because the Democrats in Washington allowed Acorn to be targeted and taken down without a whimper. And it was a complete setup. They framed them from beginning to end. We have proof that Acorn employees called the cops after O'Keefe and the girlfriend showed up. This whole thing was a total concoction. And to me, the continuing embarrassment is that the Democrats joined forces with the Republican to cut off all funding to Acorn based on a witch hunt that didn't ever even, produce a hearing in Congress. They basically relied on the jimmied footage that was on Fox and then just said, okay, Acorn, you're done.
Yeah, not surprising, though.
And
they were running scared. They were panicked.
Well, and this, I think, is a trait, a character flaw that we're seeing, and you don't identify that in particular in your column in the new issue of Harper's Magazine entitled Donkey Business. But talk a little bit. You have done extensive exposure of the extreme right, the Tea Party, the tactics they use, how after the 08 election they doubled down and were generally successful in advancing many of their political themes.
At a time when it was extremely unlikely. I mean, they shouldn't have been able to get away with any of it. It was like their we've talked about this 100 times before. Their views had just driven the country off a cliff. And here they go out and they're like, no, no, we didn't drive off the cliff fast enough. And they were able to sell that.
Yeah.
You know? It was incredible.
And
it
so
was incredible. And part of it was things like you know, that Acorn's voice was silenced. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was just it was coincidence that it happened at that time. But Acorn is something that's, you know, that's a voice that should have been present during all the debate about the financial crisis and, what was going on in housing. And we never heard from them because obviously they were gone
mm-hmm.
by then.
Mm-hmm. And so in your column this month, you take a hard look at the Democratic Party. And it isn't that pretty. What we see is a party that has really compromised on many issues, failed to take the Republicans head on, and now they are basically kind of accepting that this midterm election will it's highly unlikely that Pelosi will return as Speaker to a Democratic-controlled chamber, and the Senate is definitely in play. And while I'm sure we're both really sad that Lynn Cheney has pulled out in Wyoming, still, there is great risk that Republicans will take the Senate this November.
I think that's right. I think it's probably a 50-50 chance, which is astonishing given that just last year, I mean, they just finished shutting down the government and bringing the nation to the brink of default.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's quite incredible that they could – that they if they pull it off, that they would get – that they would make a comeback that quickly. But that's – I mean, that's really – that's the point – that's one of the points that I've been making for a really long time. And I make this point, and I make this point, and I discover that nobody really heard me. So I go back and do it again. and the point is this. The Republicans are – I mean, their positions on paper are profoundly unpopular, okay? So, like, you know, their attitudes about economics and about the banks and all the different things of Social Security, you go right down the list – profoundly unpopular. Then what do? They shut down the government. This is like beyond profoundly unpopular. It's, you know, it should be like the equivalent of swallowing the cyanide pill for a political party. And yet the Democrats are not really able to make it stick. You know, mm-hmm. they should be finishing these guys off. They should be mopping up, you know, it should be like the end of World War II. They should be mopping up the last few pockets of resistance or something. No, no. These guys have they have the House of Representatives. There's a really good chance they're going to get the Senate. It's quite incredible. Now, look, I have spent years making fun of Republicans. It's a blast. It's a hoot. You know, there's no end of raw material there.
Oh, come on. You're shooting fish in a barrel.
Exactly. At a certain point, you have to say, why doesn't the other party make them pay for all of these blunders?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't they do it?
Well, let's take...
That's just as valid a question, if not...
But let's take the government shutdown as a case in point here, because... President Obama, for the first time in one of these confrontations, was listening to me, and he held out. He didn't cave in. He didn't compromise
right.
this time.
He played that very well, I thought.
He did. And so the Democrats had a period of 36 to maybe even 48 hours where it looked like, wow, we have vanquished the Republicans. Obamacare's rolling out next. That's going to be the next little pummel of the Republican Party. And then, boom, the website sucked, and people couldn't keep their plans the way they wanted. And the general mess that is Obamacare was exposed for all to see.
That's right.
And now the Democrats are back on the defensive. And despite what you just said about how profoundly unpopular most Republican positions are, they're moving forward. They're picking up momentum right now.
That's right. That's right. They are. And you have to remember one thing about Obamacare when you're discussing things like that is that it itself was a huge compromise,
mm-hmm.
Supposedly with the Republicans, but they didn't get any of them to sign off on it anyways. But it was a massive compromise in the first place, and it was far more complicated than it needed to be, far more intrusive into people's personal lives, and it also screwed over a lot of their allies, like organized labor, which has spent years bargaining for these, you know, healthcare plans mm-hmm. that they're very proud of and everything. And it was, it, you know, it was a huge compromise in the first place. But that's, you know, that's typical of these guys. So, yeah, they've managed to squander their momentum from all that. But look, the larger point is this: that I start the article by thinking about the way that Democrats, progressives, talk and think about the GOP, and a lot of it is pretty dismissive. They first of all say, well, you know, we have got everything nailed down in the future. We don't really have to – this is the Democrats here that I'm talking about. We don't have to worry about winning elections because, you know, we have – the demographics are on our side. You know, this rising tide. Mm-hmm. They have this term for it, the coalition of the ascendant, you know, which means minorities, what they call millennials, which means young people, and professionals. Right, that's the Democratic coalition. Can do you know who's missing from that? Who's the most obvious example? Who's
missing? I didn't hear anything about women, and I didn't hear anything about labor.
Yeah, right. There you go. Mm-hmm. That's you nailed it. So yeah, working people.
I think, you know, just to rely on the symbolism, citing the 12 convention in a right to work state was a signal that labor don't matter anymore to the Democratic Party.
Yeah. Oh, they matter. They matter on election day, right? That's who does all the work. They drive those, you know, the vans taking mm-hmm. people to the polls, and they go door to door, and you know, they work desperately, you know, always trying to save themselves.
$400 million from labor.
Yeah,
in
that's right.
The
of
last
course,
cycle.
That's their biggest donor too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, and they get what they get. It's always a disaster for them. You know, it just goes a little bit slower if they put their back into it. But that's but Democrats here in Washington have convinced themselves that they really are the party of the future, and they got nothing to worry about. Or that was the reaction immediately after the 2012 election. There was this air of triumphalism that swept over progressive land, you know, making fun of Mitt Romney, this unbelievable loser, and you know, we've got everything sewn up for you know, from here into the future. And then suddenly everything turned bad, and the Republicans shut down the government, and the progressive, you know, hive mind changed, you know, swerved on a dime and said, how is this happening? How did these guys manage to retain control of the House of Representatives? And they settled on this explanation. It's all because of gerrymandering. It all happened because of gerrymandering. And by the way, that's, you know, true to a certain degree. There's these, you can easily find these incredibly gerrymandered congressional districts that allowed Republicans to win when they probably shouldn't have.
You can also map that there are 25 or so Tea Party members of the House who are completely safe in the districts that have been drawn for them up through 2020.
Well, safe by what standard? Safe by the standard that
either
they have more
Neanderthal person
Republicans. Well, you know, in their district,
right? But it's not in play. It's not these districts are not vulnerable to a Democrat.
You say they're not. You say they're not in play. We're getting off on a sidetrack here. They're not in play because the Democrats don't put them in play. Okay, I'll give you an example. I grew up in Johnson County, Kansas, which is a suburb of Kansas City. It's a Republican district in the sense that it has more registered Republicans than Democrats by a mile. Okay, but for about the last 10 years, longer than that, beginning in the 90s, we had a Democrat as our representative in Congress. And he was kind of an interesting guy. You know, I met him a couple of times. Well, he retired 3 years ago now, or was it 4 years ago? He retired. And this last year, in 2012, the Democrats did not contest the seat. They held this seat for years. They held the seat. They didn't even try. They didn't even put somebody up. You look at Boehner's seat in Ohio. They didn't even contest it. And so, you know, Boehner's able to go out there and say things like, you know, it's a center-right country and stuff like this. They didn't even try. What kind of party is this? You know, to get back to the point I was making. So first they believe in this thing about the coalition of the ascendant, which is partially true within its limited parameters. Then they immediately switch to complaining about gerrymandering, also partially true. But what's really true about these things, and what brings them together when you think about it, these are excuses. These are excuses for not challenging the other side. First of all, because they think they don't have to. And second of all, because they think, you know, that the other side has cheated in all these circumstances and there's nothing can be done about them. And of course, I'm sorry. I get the democratic mind or the progressive mind is weirdly given to these fatalistic explanations of political, you know, of political events of history. I remember the one that used to drive me crazy was when they talk about the pendulum swinging. Mm-hmm. You ever hear this one?
Oh yeah.
They say, well, you know, the Republicans have been or conservatism has more or less been running everything since 1968. You know, in the country. First swerved right, but it'll swerve back. You know, the other side's gone too far. One of these days it'll come back. We don't have to do anything. It'll just happen very naturally. And a perfect example of this attitude is progressives, liberals generally love that website 538.com, or mm-hmm. that's what it used to be called. You know, where yeah. you can
Nate Silver.
Nate Silver, where he does all the math for you and he adds up the polls and he has this very scientific way of determining who's going to win what race and turns out to be extremely accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And this is almost a religious thing among progressives. They turn on the computer and immediately go to that and see, you know, who's going to win North Carolina and stuff like that. Conservatives don't approach the world in this fatalistic way. I mean, they do to a certain degree. Everybody does. But they have a much more entrepreneurial culture, you know, their movement culture, because if you go back to the beginnings, this is a group that has always had an uphill race against demographics. You know, they're trying to sell something that essentially they shouldn't be able to sell, you know? I mean, you can see how Nixon might have won in 68, but Reagan? No, come on! Gingrich? This is insane! Bush, you know, Bush Jr.? These are political positions that the country is just objectively not interested in. The only way they put them over is with clever salesmanship, building this movement, being relentlessly entrepreneurial. The Tea Party movement is the, you know, most recent and sort of classic example of this. I mean, they'd have these conventions where everybody's trying to sell something to somebody else. They're all, you know, they're all salesmen. It's fascinating. But that's the difference between their movement culture and that of the Democrats. And I sit there looking at the Democrats basically giving up on the huge parts of the country because it's like, oh, it's gerrymandered. There's nothing we can do about it. And it's like, do you ever read the stories about in like the Washington Post about these gerrymandered districts, these Tea Party districts? There's a really interesting thing that unites them all, other than them all being representative by, you know, right-wing crazies. And that thing is, these are really hard hit economically. All these districts, you say they're gerrymandered, say they're represented by a Tea Party guy, whatever. They have higher than usual unemployment. You know, the jobs aren't coming back. The Washington Post did a series about these districts, and the stories that come out of there are just, you know, really sad. They're mm-hmm. awful. Or you look at a place like West Virginia, which is for the last 10 years has been transitioning to the Republicans. You know, it's kind of a bizarre story because when we were younger, West Virginia was one of the most bedrock, not just Democrat. It was not just a Democratic state. It was way to the left.
Yeah.
You know, that was who they were. And today it's gone pretty far the other direction, and the chances are that the Republicans will basically pick it up.
There might be something in the water.
Yeah, isn't that an awful story?
Mm-hmm.
It's just, yeah.
But you know, we don't need more regulation, for God's sake.
Yeah.
That's the last thing.
That because, you know, that's where the issue that has – one of the issues that's really turned West Virginia is coal and environmentalists, which is highly ironic because modern environmentalism – got its start in West Virginia during a disaster in the late 60s. I think it was called the Buffalo Creek disaster, and I forget the exact particulars of it, but it involved coal mine runoff, a burst holding tank. I forget all the details of it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where all of this stuff started, and now
we have Joe Manchin, who puts coal dust on his Rice Krispies every morning.
Yeah. Well, I visited there. I wrote a story about this, a couple of years ago about the cult of coal in West Virginia. And it's very interesting. But again, it's a the right has taken advantage of an issue that shouldn't be theirs. You know, the idea that coal miners and coal mine owners are united in their, you know, in their economic perspective is just pure folly.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they've managed to get these groups to identify with each other. They have a campaign. They call it Friends of Coal. Okay, so it's not about mine owners and mine workers. It's about the mineral itself.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, it's so clean. That's why I'm a friend.
It is kind of.
I'm a friend of clean coal.
Don't get me started there. But, I mean, that's a story for another occasion. But so you look at these, to get back to the Tea Party and the problems that the Democrats have, you look at these gerrymandered districts. What could they do? How could they challenge them? And it's just like it leaps out at you. It's really obvious the things that Democrats used to do, you know, like identify with the unemployed, you know, the public works projects, give everyone a job. It would be – well, it wouldn't be easy, but you could – and in fact, you couldn't do it because Congress would never let you do it. But you could make it. If President Obama wanted to, or if Nancy Pelosi wanted to, I bet Nancy Pelosi actually might want to, but you could make this your signature demand mm-hmm. for 2014. Give me a modern-day WPA program. We're going to put everybody to work. We're going to rebuild the infrastructure of this country with federal money. Go out there, campaign for it every day, especially in those districts. I'll tell you what, Peter B. Collins, there is no amount of gerrymandering on earth that could keep some of those places Republican.
Well, I like that optimism. The numbers are hard to move, and
stop looking at 538.com, please.
The other thing I will note is that gerrymandering became possible because the Democrats didn't really prosecute the 2010 elections at the state level. They were busy in Washington enjoying the afterglow of the 08 victory. And at that point, I think they took their eyes off balls in at least 23 states where
that's part of the problem, we have
one-party rule.
You have to dig a little deeper to find this. But, yeah, the whole strategy of the modern Democratic Party, and I'm dating back to the Clinton administration. Do you remember this group called the Democratic Leadership Council?
Oh, sure, yeah.
The whole program there was to forget about Congress, okay? Everybody in Washington knows that power flows from the presidency. That's what you have to get. In fact, they used to make fun of Democrats. Well, of the whole idea of Democrats retaining control of the House of Representatives. Democrats used to, back in the 70s and 80s, used to say, "We have the House of Representatives forever."
Yeah.
Because of the New Deal, because obviously the Democrats are the party of the people, you know, and everyone knows that.
Hmm.
And so the part of the Democratic Leadership Council's thing was to mock that. That was mm-hmm. they thought that was ridiculous. The only thing that mattered was the presidency, and everyone knew it. And when they got the presidency for Clinton, you know, that was the whole thing, was to remake the Democratic Party so it could win the presidency, so you didn't have things like Mondale and Dukakis and McGovern and mm-hmm. So on. And they would say they succeeded in that regard. And that has become a holy writ for Democrats in Washington now, that's what matters. And so it's not a surprise when they don't care about Congress, and they don't challenge John Boehner's seat, and they, you know, or if they do, you know, they only challenge seats that they think they can win, and then they do so by, you know, nominating people who are essentially Republicans anyway, you know,
right?
Who've just changed party for convenience.
But to be very, very focused, okay, redistricting is a predictable event. And the Democrats knew it was coming. You know, we were doing the census in 2010, and it happens the same time every decade. And yet they were asleep at the wheel in 2010, and we will pay a big price for a while.
That's right. Redistricting is and gerrymandering is far more it has far greater effects at the local level. State legislatures, you know, the way cities are divided up, all this sort of thing. Its effects at the national level are reduced.
Mm-hmm.
There's some I am downplaying it because I think that Democrats let things like this stop their efforts.
Well,
of course they should have contested those elections, and they should have not let it happen.
And now allow me to agree with you, okay? I do feel that the Democrats are paying too much attention to polls. They are too slavishly following a very timid president, and they are following the corporate money that fuels their campaigns. And it has caused them to, in many ways, censor themselves. And let's take an example. Reproductive rights are under assault. New York Times just this past week showed how at the state level, more than 70 different pieces of legislation have been introduced that restrict abortion access and rights in the last 12 to 18 months. And there is no coordinated effort by the Democrats to push back. Their whole focus is, well, let's do the long shot. Let's get Wendy Davis elected in Texas. And, you know, that won't really solve problems of access to, you know, Planned Parenthood in Indianapolis, for example.
No, that's right. And so
this is an issue that is very important. It's been a core issue for the base of the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party leadership is not really prosecuting a very valuable struggle that they could be doing.
I think that's right. I wonder how they might play that differently. The funny thing is that it's the Republican push on this issue is used by Democrats for fundraising purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Constantly, they are constantly raising money on this. But you're right that they're not doing very much to stop these guys. But can I just take another step back here? There's two different ways that you could contest the rise of the right going back to from the 80s to the present. Okay, one of them is what I outlined in What's the Matter with Kansas, which is you fight for working class votes, and you hammer home your identity as a party of Roosevelt, and you do the things that I described earlier: raise the minimum wage, not just raise it, make it an enormous fight for mm-hmm. the minimum wage, fight for things like, you know, the things that I mentioned, some kind of new public works program, and you know, maybe something about abortion rights could be part of that. I don't see why not. The other that's one way of doing it, you know, to keep that part of the electorate on your side, but there's another way that you can do it, and that is to try to meet the Republicans halfway and to fight for the center. Okay, and that's what the Democratic Party actually chose to do, what they call the center, and I should always put that in quotation marks, to fight over what they call the center, because that way they get to, you know, the center is all about who is nicer to the banks and this kind of thing, and that's obviously much more profitable from a fundraising point of view, and they've consistently and repeatedly chosen that as the way to deal with their sagging fortunes.
But George Lakoff has clearly shown that the center of American politics does not respond in the way that
That's
politicians
right.
imagine.
And in fact, the word doesn't even mean what they think it means.
Right.
It has nothing
and
to do with
it,
what they
to
think
put it
means.
In simple terms, Tom, I believe going back to 2004 with Kerry, that we have seen one Democratic leader after another try to play to the center and fail to lead his or her base. And if you lead the base on issues that they're passionate about, the center will come along with that base.
Exactly.
But
you
cannot pander to the center, and you cannot lead from the center. It simply doesn't work.
All right, that's right. Let me say, it goes back further than that. Dukakis is the classic example.
Mm-hmm.
Although a lot of people in Washington believe he was some kind of ultra leftist, he was nothing of the kind. He was, you know, a classic sort of Mitt Romney type. You know, he was a technocrat, to a certain degree, Walter Mondale was too. But the fascinating thing about all this is the idea of the center. Okay, so I'll give you what's a classic centrist proposal. Well, I'll give you two of them. One of them is NAFTA.
Yeah,
free trade agreements. That's what centrism is all about. Another, deregulation, bank deregulation specifically in the Clinton years. And there were books written about what a great thing this was that Clinton did. You know, there's one on my shelf here about the where bank deregulation, the final overturn of Glass-Steagall, is the telos towards which all history is heading. And once we finally achieve that, that's centrism, you know, or getting NAFTA passed. That's centrism. And what they mean by, and these are obviously things that are not popular with the American people, not even close to popular, you know. And so what they mean by centrism is something that the consensus of the kind of Washington Beltway lobbyist community believes in and agrees upon. And they're doing this again right now. There's something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a new free trade agreement that the Obama administration is negotiating, yes, in secret.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we found out what little we know about it thanks to, like, Edward Snowden. You know, it's unbelievable. But this is what – so I'm
actually,
saying,
just to be fair, it's coming from WikiLeaks, not Snowden.
Oh, sorry,
this time.
Sorry. I'm getting my leakers mixed
and
up.
And you are correct here. I believe there are 28 chapters to the secret Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, and only 5 of them relate to trade. And the others, from everything we can glean and from what has been leaked, are aimed at giving corporations power over little governments like the United States of America and its its subdivisions, and
it's very similar to NAFTA,
right? Except NAFTA was negotiated in in much more open circumstances.
That's right, but the result of NAFTA, I mean, it's not really a trade treaty. It's a a sort of a property protection treaty, so that mm-hmm. Mexico can't nationalize American stuff ever again, like they did back in the 1930s. It's that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what they've got to offer. That's what President Obama has to offer to those voters in those really hard bitten districts in West Virginia and those Tea Party districts that we're talking about.
And
these
All
are
right.
people
and
unemployed.
Just recently, on the 50th anniversary of LBJ's accidental war on poverty, Obama
he said it. He meant to say it. It wasn't accidental.
Well, no, but the speech was about reducing nuclear processing, and then he said, "And I want to start a war on poverty." So on the 50th anniversary, with some fanfare, the Obama White House announces 5 promise zones, and these are sacrifice zones, essentially, that they're saying, well, we're going to invest something in, and there isn't a dime for Detroit. I couldn't believe it. And this is the same White House that has allowed Michigan to become a right-to-work state without a whimper. Now, it's not as if Obama could have stopped it, but he certainly could have spoken up about it.
You know what Obama could have done? We always forget the great missed opportunity of his first term, which was the Employee Free Choice Act, also mm-hmm. known as Card Check.
Yeah.
The fact is that he could have reversed the demise of organized labor if he wanted to. And he said he wanted to when he was in the U.S. Senate. He could have made it very easy for people to form a labor union. And why not? Mm-hmm. It's a universal human right. People ought to have that right, and it's essentially impossible in America today. And it would be politically good for him because union members obviously tend to vote Democratic. But there's, look, the center, meaning the funders, don't like things like that. what I'm describing here is a Democratic Party that wants its base to turn out and counts on its base to turn out and, in fact, expects them to turn out in a demographic sense, expects them to deliver elections to the Democratic Party from here to eternity, but doesn't really want to do anything for those people, anything substantive for those people, because that would cost them with their funders.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
that's what
and
we're talking about.
Case in point is this very lame effort to extend unemployment benefits. Also, tagging on what we talked about earlier, the last big victory for Democrats was in not caving in to the government shutdown threat. That produced a loss of job creation in November and December. The numbers just came out in January. I haven't heard any prominent Democrat point a finger at Republicans and say the reason job creation slumped is because you introduced uncertainty into the economy. And then you piled on by not extending unemployment benefits, and the very clear lack of that stimulus on the economy is what is producing, at least in part, these weak job numbers. But we don't see anything about that.
Yeah, well, look, and there's a cost to not contesting this stuff that goes further than just the politics of it. And that's the cost of – I mean, you look at what's happening in our culture. And I know it's beyond a political party to be able to challenge what's going on in our culture, but with some, you know, intelligent leadership, you could think about it, you could do things in a different way. And what I mean is this: when the economy went off a cliff back in 08 and 09, the sort of Fox News worldview, the sort of entrepreneurial conservative worldview that I have been describing all these years, saw their advantage and took it. And the advantage was and what they proceeded to do was to blame the downturn on the little guy, you know, and blame blame everything on your neighbor, you know, and sort of invert the entire way that we talk about economics. So it's not the bank's fault, it's the borrower's fault. You know, it's the guy that took out a house. You remember the famous Santelli rant that launched the Tea Party movement, mm-hmm. where he's essentially blaming individual borrowers for the downturn and for the bailout.
Predatory borrowers.
I love that term.
You know, those people came in.
But he's doing it from the floor of the Chicago Board of Trade. I love that.
On CNBC, yes.
And he's doing it on behalf of the traders of America.
Uh-huh.
And this sold. This worked. This stupid way, this totally upside down way of looking at the world actually caught on and gained adherence and had people running around in parks with megaphones and flags. And it's with us to this day, this poisonous, this toxic, this upside-down way of understanding things. Why? Because nobody challenges it. I mean,
okay.
There's people like you and me.
And Tom, here is the flip side of that. We are now at the five-year point where the statute of limitations is running out. Not a single executive who presided over those toxic mortgages that nearly brought down our economy has been prosecuted or, you know, has to worry in any way about lawyering up and facing hard time in the penitentiary. And Obama has allowed this to occur. And not only do I believe it's obstruction of justice, but it loses a critical issue to fight over. And a very critical position that the Democratic Party should be taking. And we now have this budget deal that, you know, I'm grateful that we're not going to have a shutdown imminently. We've got a debt ceiling fight coming up in a couple of months.
By the way, can I just add, you're talking about an issue that would have been a huge winner for these guys.
Yes.
Enormous winner politically.
This new budget deal cuts money for enforcement on Wall Street.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, how can they possibly contemplate that?
Because they don't have to worry about it. Remember, they have the coalition of the ascendant right at their back. They don't have to worry about anything, Peter B. Collins. You know?
I'm sorry, some music just entered our conversation here. It was Joshua Redman who just decided to blow his saxophone while we were talking.
Well,
my apologies.
I didn't hear it.
So you know, we have the campaign coming up, but the Democrats have not really staked out critical positions to win the support and activate their base and overcome the gerrymandering and the other excuses that will be used to explain their probable losses this fall.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder. No, that's right. They've got time. Look, there's time, Peter B. If they wanted to, they could make. And it still looks like they might make raising the minimum wage into a signature issue for this fall. We'll see. They could turn around. But everything I've been describing, this has been going on. This is not a recent development. This is who they are, and this is who they've been for a long time now, where they are torn between actually putting together a politics that everyone knows would succeed because it succeeds. Succeeded in the past and gave us the Democratic Party of Roosevelt and Truman and Johnson and Kennedy and all the, you know, many victories in those years, and they were the hegemonic party in this country. They could do that, go down that route if they wanted, but there's no money in that. There's no money in that, and so there, you know, the way that they always choose to go, you know, is both more remunerative, and they think, well, look, we're going to win anyways now. We've got this coalition. You know, who cares about those Tea Party districts? We don't need to wipe them out. We've got this, you know, we're going to win the presidency from here to eternity. Doesn't matter who the Republicans nominate. You know, we got it. They are this is what happens when you think about the world in this very fatalistic way.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry to be so pessimistic, but, you know. You invited me on. You knew what you were going to get.
Right? Yes, yes, I did. So do you have any bromides, prescriptions, or advice for people who don't want to see the Republicans win this year?
There's also hopeful news out there. I haven't reported on it in this particular show. I haven't reported on it, period. But there are plenty of good Democrats out there, and there are lots of Democrats who know about who know what should be done differently. There's lots of them. And I am often surprised that we hear from them more now than we used to. You know, I'm talking about the sort of progressive wing of the party, the Elizabeth Warren wing. That these people are much more visible now than they were in the past, and so I shouldn't be entirely negative. You still do have these other Democrats out there whose heads are on straight. We shall see.
Well, very interesting, Tom. And I just want to ask your thoughts, because I've done a lot of coverage about the NSA, Edward Snowden's exposures. That's not a major focus of yours, so I don't want to put you on the spot. But I am curious if you have any reaction to the so-called reforms that the president articulated in his speech on Friday, and if you think that the public will accept what he's offering as anything substantial.
I have only read the barest coverage of it, because I was in a kind of news-free zone. I was in Kansas City when this happened, so I wasn't able to. But from what I understand, he's offering something that's not going to change very much. Is that right?
Well, they may change the name of some programs.
Yeah. Okay. Listen. There's a real good chance that you're going to have President Rand Paul in 3 years. This is an issue that just turns people's stomach.
Yeah.
It is disgusting. I think if Snowden had done it right, he might. You know, had he made these revelations before the election, so that we could actually have candidates talk about them. I mean, it might have been. Although, you know, Mitt Romney was such a dunce; he wouldn't have done anything with it. Anyway,
he would have said, "I want to double the NSA."
Yeah, that's right. You're not spying enough.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
but double their budget, double your spying, double your fun.
One of the things, I mean, this is just one of the many ways in which the Democratic, the coalition of the ascendant idea is really weak, is that one of the three. Legs of the stool, the millennials, are real, real big on privacy issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see how a certain kind of libertarian Republican candidate could easily use this issue to beat the Democrats 2 years from now. Now, I don't know if Hillary Clinton is exposed on this issue, but I don't see why not. I mean, she was part of his administration.
Mm-hmm.
I could easily see this becoming the issue that turns it against them.
I agree with you. I think it's from purely a political perspective, you're right about the millennials, but the polling also shows that partisan Republicans view Obama's NSA with great concern. So it's a political football in that respect. And, you know, I keep waiting for some principled Democrats beyond Ron Wyden to stand up and say, members of my party object to the shaving of our constitutional rights.
Yeah.
and these fatuous claims. I mean, you know, on the very day the president gave his speech saying, I'm going to keep collecting your telephone metadata, but I promise you we won't look at it unless we have reasonable suspicion, which of course is below probable cause. On that same day, the Times reported that millions of text messages are grabbed every day by the NSA. And that's not metadata. That's the whole thing. It's, you know, you get a text message, you're seeing the content of that communication.
And this, by the way, this is the candidate who promised when he was running for president in 08 that he was going to repeal parts of the Patriot Act. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He also promised he was going to renegotiate NAFTA. It's sick making. It's loathsome. I understand why he does it. I mean, we all understand why he does it. He doesn't want to be weak. He doesn't want to appear weak on terrorism. He also doesn't want a repeat of 9/11, and he'll do anything to prevent that from happening. But that logic is also what got us into Vietnam. Johnson didn't want to be the one to lose Southeast Asia, and then once he'd gotten us in there, he didn't want to be the first. Oh, or was it Nixon that didn't want to be the first American president to lose a war? Do you remember?
Mm-hmm.
And it just went on and on and on by this political logic of its own. And this is the same reasoning. And it's, there has to come a point where these people are held accountable for not only violating their promises, but for this, for doing this. This is an outrage.
And in this speech, he had James Clapper and Keith Alexander sitting in the front row as he tossed out bouquets to the intelligence community, and not even a reprimand for Clapper's clear perjury before the Senate committee. No reprimand for the dissembling that Keith Alexander gave us as each subsequent Snowden revelation proved that he was lying.
Yeah. And so I guess, but this is more centrism. This is more clever triangulation. This is what people in Washington, D.C. think of as like really, that is statesmanlike politics.
Well, I described it as an attempt at perception management.
Yeah. But it's that is centrism in action, sir.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that he might do better going the other direction probably hasn't even occurred to his people.
Well, there was one guy at the NSA who floated the proposal of giving clemency to Snowden, partly because they'd like to know exactly how much stuff he got. And they figure that asking him is the only way they'll ever really know. His name is Leggett, something like that. He's a counsel at the NSA, and uh-huh. and he floated that and was knocked around pretty quickly.
Tell me, to your knowledge, has the Tea Party movement Tea Party people got on board with? What do they think of Snowden? Is what I'm wondering. Because you remember when they started, the Tea Party movement has already changed its stripes quite a bit from when the day it started. But when it started, it was a, openly libertarian.
Mm-hmm.
This is the Glenn Beck thing and all that. And I've stopped following it.
The latest Pew poll that was just out yesterday is surprising in some ways because it shows that well over 50% think that the government has gone too far. But the jury on Snowden in particular is almost 50-50.
Uh-huh.
And so even people who oppose the government overreach, some of them take the government's position that Snowden was a traitor.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's complicated. That's a legal thing. The thing is that I think it's what we know is an outrage, regardless mm-hmm. regardless of his legal status. It's just unbelievable what's going on. But to get back to the politics of it, this is an opening for a libertarian. This is an opening for someone who takes this stuff seriously. And you present this right to the American public, that's going to be a strong political issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we will see that in 2014. Well, this is 2014, 2016. God, I don't want to talk about that. Oh, my Lord.
Hey, are you ready for Hillary?
Oh, Peter B. Collins. By that time, I want to be writing about a completely different subject. A completely different subject.
Well, you better get started. Tom Frank, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for rambling with me today. And I want to invite people to read your monthly column in Harper's Magazine, Easy Chair.
You got it, Peter B. Anytime.
And another rambling encounter with Tom Frank. I would appreciate your comments and feedback. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. keep smiling.